want to absolve themselves from what their governments are doing by refusing to be part of a genocidal war in the 21st century.
I want to end with Dr. Feroz Sidwa, a trauma surgeon who's currently volunteering at European Hospital in Khan Yunis in Gaza right now. We've been trying to reach him nonstop for the show today, but in case we couldn't, which we can't, he can almost never do live communication. It just doesn't work. He sent us this voice message. He's working with the Palestinian American Medical Association in collaboration with the World Health Organization. On Sunday, Dr. Sidwa sent this update as he walked from his living quarters to the European hospital.
The hospital itself is basically a displaced persons camp. I just walked out of my, I live in a little building called the Medan, I think it's square. It's kind of an outlying area of the hospital. And just walking into the hospital, it's only about a 5-minute walk. It's just squalor everywhere. The kids running around without shoes, kids running out of sores, people actually wheeling their family members around in hospital beds sometimes. A bunch of cars that can't move anywhere because there's no gasoline. They're using them as beds and shelters sometimes. But, you can see there's no privacy, no dignity for any of these people, but they somehow maintain their humanity. It's pretty impressive to see, actually. I'm walking by the four latrines that people share here. I'm told there's 20,000 people on this on the hospital grounds, and they share four latrines. It's ridiculous. You can imagine the smell. And it's literally right in front of the hospital main entrance, which is also a giant tent city. The way these people attempt to maintain some of their own dignity and humanity, they're maintaining their custom of Ramadan, they're still staying in family units despite the fact that they have been displaced multiple times each. A lot of them, this is their, leaving aside the, 1948 and 1967 displacements, as some of them have been displaced three or four times just from this war. Half of the medical students, their families are dead. They were displaced. Hello. Half of them were displaced from, the kids love to say hello to anybody that they figure out is a foreigner. Half the medical students, their families, their family members have died. And still, they're not even in medical school down here, but they come down here, and they just came to Gaza European Hospital to volunteer. And they actually run the emergency room for the most part right now.
That was Dr. Feroz Sidwa at European Hospital in Khan Yunis Sunday. Final words to Dr. Hassan Abousata, who is recently out of Gaza, British Palestinian reconstructive surgeon. Your final thoughts.
Today, as we grieve for our friend, one tries to maintain a level of hope. And so we end with the words of the immortal Bobby Sands. We will defeat them with the laughter of our children.
Dr. Hassan Abousata, I want to thank you so much for being with us. British-Palestinian reconstructive surgeon, worked in Gaza for over a month as a volunteer with Doctors Without Borders, treating patients at both Al-Shifa, which has now been almost totally destroyed, and Al-Ahli Baptist Hospitals. When we come back, Palestinian Christians face severe restrictions this weekend on entering the Old City in Jerusalem to mark Easter Sunday. We'll go to Bethlehem to speak with Dr. Munta Isaac, pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem, famous for the crèche he made at Christmas, Christ in the Rubble. Stay with us. Name of the Land by Naivar Guti. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As Christians around the world celebrated Easter Sunday, Palestinians faced severe restrictions on entering the Old City in Jerusalem. Palestinian Christians from the occupied West Bank were prevented from reaching Jerusalem for Good Friday to walk the Via Dolorosa, the path Jesus is said to have followed on the way to his crucifixion more than 2,000 years ago. Even before October, Palestinian Christians had to seek permission to visit the Old City. In Bethlehem, where Jesus was born, the wall separating Israel from the West Bank cuts through the city, largely empty of tourists this weekend. The Reverend Munter Isaac, who is the pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem, participated in Easter Vigil for Gaza on Saturday. This is some of what he said.
Today we have entered a new phase of the war of genocide, in which the people of Gaza are being killed by hunger, thirst, and disease. They are starved to death. It is a slow death. They are hanging between heaven and earth, dying slowly while the world is watching. They have no form or majesty that we should look at them. From whom men hide their faces? It took more than 5 months and 32,000 people killed, including 13,000 children, for the UN Security Council to finally pass a ceasefire. But nothing has changed on the ground. Since when does Israel care about UN resolutions? Israel has never been held accountable or even condemned by Western leaders. This remains the single biggest problem today. Right now, we are pleading for aid and food to enter. We gave up on a ceasefire. Just bring food, water, and medicine. Lord, have mercy. Friends, a genocide has been normalized. And as people of faith, if we truly claim to follow a crucified Savior, we can never be okay with this. We should never accept the normalization of a genocide. We should never be okay with children dying from starvation, not because of drought or famine, but starvation, man-made catastrophe, because of the empire. A genocide has been normalized, just as apartheid was normalized in Palestine. And before that, in South Africa, just as slavery and the caste system were normalized. It has been firmly established to us that the leaders of the superpowers and those who benefit from the modern colonialism do not look at us as equals. They created the narrative to normalize genocide. They have a theology for it. A genocide has been normalized. This is racism at its worst. And the very same political and church leaders who lined up in October, one after the other, to give the green light for this genocide, giving it the cover of self-defense, cannot even bring themselves to condemn the obvious war crimes being committed by Israel. They are good at raising their concern. They make statements that they are troubled by the killing of our children. We're sorry that the killing of our children by your weapons actually troubled you. They want to convince us that they actually care. So they raise funds, they are silent during the genocide, and then show up afterwards with charity to say that they care. Can we really accept this? Many countries rushed to suspend their funding of UNRWA based on mere allegations that were not fully proven, yet did nothing with regards to the clear findings of the ICJ. The amount of hypocrisy is incomprehensible, and the level of racism involved for such hypocrisy is appalling. And now some politicians claim that their patience with Israel is ending, and we say nothing can wash the blood from your hands.
That was the Reverend Munter Isaac. Isaac in English, pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church. speaking in Bethlehem at an Easter vigil for Gaza Saturday. Joining us now from Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. Reverend Isaac, thank you for joining Democracy Now! Again. You joined us at Christmas time after you'd made that famous Christ in the rubble. I'm wondering if you can share a description of what's happening in Bethlehem today in the occupied West Bank, and also talk about what happened on Good Friday.
Thank you for having me. Bethlehem, like the rest of Palestinian cities in the West Bank, continue to be almost completely isolated since the war began. And when I say isolated, I'm not just referring to the fact that we cannot go to Jerusalem, but even a trip to other Palestinian towns and cities right now is a big hassle. It's a risky trip because of the potential of settler violence on the roads that Israel control between all the Palestinian towns and cities. And the delays that the checkpoints are causing. Sometimes you could wait up to 2 to 3 hours just on the checkpoint with no movement. It's all part of intimidation and control. And as I said, here in Bethlehem, we're also completely now isolated from Jerusalem. Jerusalem is 15, 20 minutes drive from where I'm speaking from. Jerusalem, you know, we used to be considered like another neighborhood in Jerusalem, like two twin cities. But right now, for the first time in history, we are completely isolated as Bethlehem and Jerusalem.
And again, if you could talk about what happened on Good Friday, the procession in the Old City.
Well, it was not the normal procession. I mean, at least in previous years, some Palestinian Christians from the West Bank were given those permits by the Israeli military to cross to Jerusalem and attend, whether the Via Dolorosa of Jerusalem or visit Jerusalem, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre during the Holy Week. Permits are not available these days. The normal processions and prayers that take place in the Old City with many faithful were missing, and you could see that very small numbers took part in these prayers. And let's be clear, the idea that we need a permit is ridiculous to begin with. That's the problem. The problem is not that Israel is not giving us permits. The problem is that we need permits to begin with, as Palestinian Christians from Bethlehem or Ramallah, that we need those permits to go to Jerusalem. This is the real scandal here.
Can you describe the wall through Bethlehem for people to understand who haven't been there?
Yes, it's a really ugly concrete barrier that's taller even than the Berlin Wall that cuts deep into some of our neighborhoods. It's very visible from very many places in Bethlehem. It gives the impression that we live in a big prison. And this is not just an impression, because all it takes for Israel right now is to close two checkpoints, and then we're completely isolated in Bethlehem. The wall speaks volumes. I mean, it's the message that it's sending, that we're not wanted, that we're as if dangerous. There is a psychological effect to it, again, because it's very visible. And the route of the wall is very indicative. As I said, it cuts deep into Palestinian neighborhoods in Bethlehem. And it basically confiscated all the land surrounding Bethlehem area. By that, I mean the agricultural land and land that would have been the space for natural expansion. That's why Bethlehem is very crowded right now. And when we say it confiscated Palestinian land, please understand, I'm not just making a political statement as if to say this is Palestinian land. This is land owned and farmed by Palestinian families, including Palestinian Christian families, for generations. But the wall has completely isolated us from these, from our lands.
Reverend Muntar Isaac, if you can talk about Gaza now, how many Christians, Palestinian Christians, are there? Why didn't most Christians leave Gaza City to go to Rafah?
Yes, there is around anything between 800 to 900 Palestinian Christians
left in the Gaza Strip. And as you said, most of them preferred to stay in Gaza, in the city, and they preferred to take refuge in one of the two churches, the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church, with the Catholic Church now hosting the majority because it has a bigger compound with a school. The decision was made, from what they told us, by everyone involved. They met and they decided that they don't want to go to the unknown. They don't want to end up in tents in Egypt, maybe, or in the desert. Don't forget that many still carry the memories of 1948, the Nakba. So they don't want to leave their homes again. And the message they told us is they'd rather die in the church rather than leave to the unknown and end up somewhere that they don't know. So they chose to be together. They chose to be in the two churches. And at times, it was very difficult. The Shifa Hospital is from walking distance from the two churches. So you could imagine the amount of trauma and fear they experienced. Many were killed in this war already, whether by bombardment or by snipers, or from diseases. You know, the problem right now is if you get sick in Gaza, chances are very high you don't survive because there is no medical care at all.
I wanted to ask you two questions. One about the Pope giving his Easter sermon at the Vatican, calling for a ceasefire. While he called for peace, a Republican member of the U.S. Congress publicly suggested Gaza should be bombed, quote, like Nagasaki and Hiroshima. It was Michigan Congress member Tim Walberg, who himself is an ordained pastor, who made the comment during a recent town hall. Listen carefully. It's a little off mic.
We shouldn't be spending a dime on humanitarian aid. It should be like Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Get it over quick.
Your thoughts. Shouldn't be sending a dime of humanitarian aid, and it should be dealt with like the U.S. dealt with Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
I'm angry. It really makes me angry. And I've heard these comments, and I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe it. It makes me angry as a Christian, makes me furious as a Christian for the lack of mercy and compassion. This is definitely not Jesus' way. I can't understand which Bible are they reading. And then when I search about this congressman, only to discover that he went to prestigious and influential evangelical seminaries. He was a pastor. I couldn't believe it. I mean, this is a stain on the credibility of the Christian witness. And the idea that he brings those two cities as a positive example is beyond my comprehension. He brings the example of two cities that were completely destroyed with hundreds of thousands killed as a positive example. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that. You know, he would think of that, only to think that the real scary part of all of this is that Israel could actually do it and get away with it because of people like him providing the political and theological cover to execute such a genocide, just as we've been witnessing for the last 5 to 6 months. This is the scary part, that he thinks of it as a possibility and that we know that if it happens, there are those who will continue to defend it. I'm horrified by this. As a pastor, I'm appalled and I'm angry because this is not a Christian witness.
Finally,
and we need more cause for ceasefire. We need stronger cause for a ceasefire like the one Pope Francis made. We need those church leaders to come to the Holy Land, come and demand a ceasefire. It's beyond tragic. We need to be very forceful in our demand right now for a ceasefire.
Finally, in a moment, we're going to be talking about the mass protests in Tel Aviv around calling for, it used to be the resignation of Prime Minister Netanyahu. Now it's for the overthrow of the government. Your thoughts?
Well, I think Netanyahu should have resigned on October 7th. He led us to this mess. And I'm not just saying that because of his negligence, but his policies, this current Israeli government's policies, their policies with regard to continuing the split between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, empowering one over the other, even bringing cash money, the fact that they intentionally killed the two-state solution, all of that led us, I mean, these are all the policies that led us to this mess. And we've been saying that things are about to explode. We've been warning for that. So to me, he should have resigned. If he had any integrity, he should have resigned immediately after October 7th for causing the death of so many innocent Palestinians and Israeli civilians, as we are witnessing right now.
Reverend,
we definitely
Munter,
need...
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Reverend Munter Ishaq, Palestinian Christian theologian, pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem. He addressed Easter Vigil for Gaza on Saturday. Coming up, tens of thousands protested across Israel, calling for the ouster of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. We'll go to Tel Aviv for the latest in 20 seconds. Knows by Pastor T.O. Barrett and the Youth for Christ Church. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On Sunday, tens of thousands rallied across Israel calling for the ouster of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the largest protest since the October 7th attacks. In Jerusalem, police fired skunk spray at demonstrators blocking a major highway. The protesters called for a ceasefire and the release of all hostages. As calls mount for his resignation, Benjamin Netanyahu is now recovering after undergoing hernia surgery Sunday night. For more, we go to Tel Aviv to speak with Oren Ziv, reporter and photographer for 972 Magazine, who's been covering the protests, joining us from Tel Aviv. Oren, welcome back to Democracy Now! It seems that the demands have changed over the last half year, from the resignation of Benjamin Netanyahu now to his overthrow, to his ouster. Can you talk about, describe these protests across Israel and what people are calling for?
Thank you for having me. We've seen those protests before October 7, hundreds of thousands of Israelis against Netanyahu and his government and the legal changes they were leading. After October 7, of course, the Israeli public, the vast majority of it, was in shock and trauma. And many of the center-left protesters were focusing in civilian help inside Israel and also in the struggle to release the hostages. But with the weeks and the months passing, more people felt that even during time of war, and I'm talking from the Israeli mainstream perspective, Netanyahu is just dealing with his own survival, with internal politics, and also he doesn't want eventually to release the hostages with delaying the deal. And the common idea among the protesters that I spoke to, dozens of them, is that Netanyahu is delaying the war and dragging the war to save himself politically, that he doesn't really want to pay the political price to release the hostages, meaning to release Palestinian political prisoners, and therefore more people are going out. Secondly, and very interesting, while the mainstream family, like the vast majority of the families of hostages that have relatives who are held in Gaza, in the beginning they were trying to be nice and polite and have kind of apolitical protest and not to annoy the government so much because they needed the government to agree on a deal. With time, and as we're seeing that Netanyahu himself, and for sure the more extreme ministers, declared that releasing the hostages is not more important than defeating or destroying Hamas, more and more families realize that they have to go out to the streets and to protest, not just for a general deal or negotiation, but specifically against Netanyahu. They see Netanyahu and, of course, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich as the obstacles to release the relative from Gaza. And this is why on Saturday we saw that the forum that unites many of the hostages' families declared that they will not make any vigil or quiet gatherings, and they will join the more active families that were blocking roads, lighting fires, and doing more direct actions. And one of the reasons that this is happening is because Netanyahu and the people around him, in general, the right was inciting against these families, saying that they should be silent, saying they're serving Hamas by protesting, connecting between them and the anti-government protesters, although not all of them were center-left. But with this incitement against them, Netanyahu actually pushed them to unite with the anti-government protests.
If you can talk about what the protesters are saying about the future of the occupation. And also, we rarely hear that there's been this vigil outside of the military intelligence headquarters in Tel Aviv, led by the hostage families, demanding that their loved ones be released and that the Israeli government work towards that and prioritize that.
So, yes, from the beginning of the war, from days after the war began, you had a small group of radical left-wing activists protest against the war, for ceasefire, saying this, the massacre against Palestinians cannot continue, and also mentioning, of course, that in order to release the hostages, the war has to end and there has to be a ceasefire and a deal. This is a few hundreds of people that have been attacked and arrested by the police. While the mainstream public, their opinion is more complicated. Many of them support the war generally, but think that now the only way to release the hostages is a deal. But with time, more and more of them understand that also Netanyahu doesn't have a plan for the day after, regardless the horrific things, the killings in Gaza and the massacre. Netanyahu doesn't want to plan anything ahead. He doesn't want Hamas to be there. He doesn't want the PA to be there. He doesn't want any kind of Palestinian authority in Gaza. And with that understanding, many people understand that Netanyahu will just want to stay in this status of war, maybe forever. Then he doesn't have to bring the hostages. To release the hostages, he has to pay a political price to release Palestinian prisoners. This can endanger his coalition with Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and other extreme right-wing figures who oppose any release of Palestinian political prisoners. So with time, you do hear. So people are calling for ceasefire and for a deal, but from an internal Israeli perspective of releasing the hostages and thinking about the day after, and less from the perspective we're seeing abroad of just calling to end the massacre in Gaza.
And finally, we just have about 30 seconds. We last talked to you where that thousands of Israelis gathering with Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, calling for Jewish settlements in Gaza, etc. Do you see a growing group of people opposing that in Israel?
Yes, definitely. The group that was calling to settle in Gaza, among with the activists who are blocking the aid, are confronted by the Israeli mainstream public that thinks that this is irrelevant and cannot be done. And also,
Oren Zeev, we're going to have to leave it there. But I thank you so much for being with us, reporter and photographer for 972 Magazine. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
Hey, this is Thurston. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby. Yeah, keep listening.